Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. We are currently studying the book of Genesis, so open your Bible and join us as we dig into the Word. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
I don't know if you saw on the news today that D. James Kennedy passed away. One of the leading voices in conservative evangelicalism, started the Knox Seminary, a Presbyterian who held to the 5 points. And the interesting thing about looking at the press today about his passing was that unlike most nationally known ministers, preachers, especially among conservatives, they always seem to manage when they write the story that quickly encapsulates any conservative evangelical Christian's life. They always try to point out some negative thing they can find about him. When Falwell died, you know, there were certainly enough jokes made and enough people pointing at the moral majority things and stuff. But in D. James Kennedy's case, married for 51 years to the same woman, pastor of the same church for 50 years, Coral Ridge, started the evangelism explosion on school campuses around the country. I've been looking at the articles today, this afternoon, and no one could find a negative thing to say about him. So, you know, it's a shame. I wonder, as I see that previous generation of preachers and voices for conservative Christianity in America, as I see that generation passing now, as you see Kennedy, but even Falwell, or even Billy Graham, or even as you see those voices that really helped shape American conservative thought from the 1950s, 60s, 70s. And then, of course, they became the brunt of all kinds of jokes and media disparagement into the 80s and 90s. And now as they're passing on, I'm really wondering where the next generation of strong conservative evangelical voices is.
It's in Smyrna.
It's in Smyrna. Well, I appreciate that, but my footprint is nowhere near the size of those men. So I always liked James Kennedy because he was, pardon me?
I said, you're not near as political as.
Right, and not as political as Kennedy or even as Falwell or as Billy Graham. But in Kennedy's case, yeah, he was firmly grounded in the history of America and the history of the church and didn't in any way flinch from telling people that the roots of American history were firmly entrenched in Christian thought, and that it was Christianity in America that raised up the leading institutions of higher learning and had a tremendous amount of influence on even the way our Constitution was drawn up, and that American society as it stands today owes a great debt to Christianity. And he said those kind of things unflinchingly, unerringly. And so now as I see some of the fellows like even MacArthur, you know, moving up in age, and I'm just looking, I'm just wondering, I'm waiting to see. Yeah, it's not going to be Joel Osteen who's cutting it, no. The crop of young popular preachers who have a large footprint in America are no longer carrying the banner of theological, conservative, doctrinal Christianity. These days it's all kind of fame and fortune, name and claim it stuff, yeah. I heard someone, this goes back maybe 6 months, 7 months ago, talking about how if America doesn't change its ways and return to its roots and pay attention to the Bible, that God is going to judge America. And all the way through the Bible, God's judgment is made most obvious by the fact that there is a dearth of the Word, that people can't hear it, that, like Isaiah writes, God hides himself. One of the signs of God's judgment is that he actually pulls away from a society and hides himself. So when I look at America today, I don't agree with the comments that say, well, we better change or God's going to judge us. I think we're really seeing God's judgment on our society by the very fact that real, genuine knowledge of God is dissipating from the everyday conversation and from the society, and that the airwaves are full of every kind of bizarre heresy. And there's still a few guys out there, but I'm looking for those voices that had the sort of influence on politics, on Washington, that someone like James Kennedy had, and those voices just aren't out there. Instead, it's going to be people like Joel Osteen who can deliver a large voting block.
Right.
Their political influence is going to be votes, not theology, not doctrinally based. It's going to be based on influence and money. But I think as we move closer and closer to the inevitable end, we'll see God pulling away more and more. And it's a shame because America was at one time that city on a hill, that, as Reagan said, you know, that beacon, that light to the world. And anymore, we've lost our... At the same time that you've seen America lose its Christian and doctrinal and biblical moorings, you've also seen us losing our reputation around the world, even our ability to elicit the sort of goodwill that we used to be able to get out of Europe or... You know. All right, so that being said, we're in chapter 50 of the book of Genesis. And we were only, when we finished last week, we were only this one chapter away from finishing the book of Genesis. Had I had 15 more minutes last week, we could have just wrapped up the book.
Put it on us.
Oh, yeah, I'll just put it on you. Yeah. Utterly your fault. So tonight it's our intention to finish the book of Genesis and then just launch right into Exodus from there. Because Genesis and Exodus are so intimately connected, both written by the same author, and it's just simply a matter of collections of scrolls when Moses finished what we call Genesis, which was simply the first of the five books he wrote about the formation of Israel and the promises to Abraham. He just picked up and started essentially the next series of stories, and even the names that we've given them, Genesis, Exodus, those aren't even Hebrew names. The name Exodus is actually a combination of two Greek words. It's a combination of ek, which means out of, and the Greek word horos, which means road. And so it's basically the road out, or the out road. So Genesis, a Greek name that moved into English, has been imposed onto this Hebrew book. So it's really just a title that we know the book by, but it's just a continuation of Moses' writing of the history of the Abrahamic covenant and the people of Abraham. But we'll get to that when we finish chapter 50. If it was us writing the story, we would write some kind of close here. But because Moses wasn't really closing his writing, he just simply explained to us in a narrative form what happened next, and then he moves immediately into the book of what we call Exodus. So starting at chapter 50, verse 1, Joseph fell on his father's face and wept over him and kissed him. Joseph commanded his servants, the physicians, to embalm his father, so the physicians embalmed Israel. Now 40 days were required for it, for such was the period required for embalming, and the Egyptians wept over him for 70 days. Which is interesting to think of the Egyptians weeping for 70 days over an old Hebrew man. But he was the father of Joseph, and he was held in high esteem by the family of Joseph, and so even Pharaoh had his servants and household and everybody weeping because that was a sign of respect. The longer that any person was wept over, the higher their position in society. And in fact, there were professional mourners in Egypt. You could hire people who would walk behind the procession and cry. And the more criers you had, the more weepers you had, the more important this person must have been when everybody would see the funeral procession happen. So you could even hire people to come and weep. Which seems awfully funny, because I want to know how you apply for that job. But, you know, it's
tough gig.
I wonder how they negotiate it. It's like, well, how much do I get for $5, you know? So. And then the reason that 40 days, it says 40 days were required for embalming. When we say embalm today, we mean actually take all the blood out of your body and put pink fluid in to guarantee that you're actually really dead. And the purpose of the pink fluid they shove through your body is just to make you look better while you're laying in the casket, to pink your skin up a little bit so that when your loved ones see you, they go, well, it doesn't look quite so dead. But the embalming laws in America were to guarantee that before you put somebody in a casket in the ground, they were dead. It was a way of getting all the blood out of their body. Among the Jews, 3 days dead. They believed that it took 3 days for the spirit to finally depart the body and you'd be dead, which you see like in the death of Lazarus, where Jesus stayed away for 3 days, and then when he finally arrived, Mary and Martha said, behold, he stinks. He's actually dead now. He's decomposing. among the Egyptians, 40 days before you really put him in the tomb. So 40 days for embalming and then 70 days of weeping over him. So it was a very big deal. One of the few preachers in the world who actually knows about embalming bodies with pink fluid. Thank you very much. My checkered past comes out again. I did. I actually, I worked for a very short time in a funeral home, not on purpose. When I lived in San Francisco and was between record deals and just needed some fast money, I knew how to drive a car, so I got hired to drive limos, and the limos were owned by a funeral home. And so when I would go to pick up or drop off the cars, I'd go inside and meet the owners, who were these two young Italian crazy guys who ran a funeral home. And so they'd hire me to do all this bizarre stuff. You don't even want to hear the stories. But I watched them embalm a guy once, and it was just like, whoa, creepy. So, yeah. Yep. All right. When the days of mourning for him were past, Joseph spoke to the household of Pharaoh, saying, if now I have found favor in your sight, please speak to Pharaoh, saying, my father made me swear, saying, behold, I am about to die, and in my grave which I dug for myself in the land of Canaan, there you shall bury me. Now therefore, please let me go up and bury my father, and then I will return. And Pharaoh said, go up and bury your father, as he made you swear. So Joseph went up to bury his father, and with him went up all the servants of Pharaoh, the elders of his household, and all the elders of the land of Egypt. Can you imagine the size of that procession? Making the journey from Egypt into Canaan just to bury one man. And all the household of Joseph and his brothers and his father's household, they left only their little ones and their flocks and their herds in the land of Goshen. There also went up with him both chariots and horsemen, and it was a very great company. When they came to the threshing floor of Atad, which is beyond Jordan, they lamented there with great and sorrowful lamentation, and he observed 7 days mourning for his father. Now when the inhabitants of the land of Canaan saw the mourning at the threshing floor of Atad, they said, this is a grievous mourning for the Egyptians. Therefore, it was named Abel Mizraim, which is beyond Jordan. And thus the sons did for him as he had charged them. For his sons carried him to the land of Canaan and buried him in the cave of the field of Machpelah before Mamre, which Abraham had bought with the field for a burial site from Ephron the Hittite. And after he had buried his father, Joseph returned to Egypt, he and his brothers, and all who had gone up with him to bury his father. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, what if Joseph should bear a grudge against us and pay us back in full for all the wrong that we did to him? Now, this is a critical question because they may have assumed, well, when we first came to Egypt and Joseph recognized who we were, one of the first questions he asked is, how's your father? And so it may very well have been that for Dad's sake that Joseph's been good to us and didn't do us any harm because he wouldn't want to upset Dad. He loved Dad and Dad would hate to see this. But now that Dad's dead and Joseph has all this power and has all this authority, what if Joseph chooses to pay us back for, you know, little things like that whole throwing him in a pit and selling him into slavery? Yeah. What if he actually wanted to exact some revenge? Well, he certainly had the power and authority to do it. So they rightly started thinking, we could be in trouble here. Verse 16, so they sent a message to Joseph saying, your father charged before he died, saying, this you shall say to Joseph, please forgive, I beg you, the transgression of your brothers and their sin, for they did you wrong. Now, you won't find anywhere in the Genesis record where that conversation took place. So we don't know for sure whether that conversation took place. For all we know, these brothers, who have been a little nefarious in the past, are saying to Joseph, before Dad died, we remember this conversation where he asked you to forgive us. That may be the case, or it may be that the conversation actually did take place and that Moses is listing it as part of an actual conversation, and now they're bringing it up and saying, please, Joseph, forgive us for Dad's sake because Dad wanted you to do that. We don't know because nowhere in Genesis do you find that conversation. So you'll say this, please forgive, I beg you, the transgression of your brothers and their sin, for they did wrong. And now please forgive the transgressions of the servants of the God of your father. And Joseph wept when they spoke to him. Then his brothers also came and fell down before him and said, behold, we are your servants. But Joseph said to them, do not be afraid, for am I in God's place? That's a really good mind and heart we're seeing demonstrated here, because he's realizing something that you're going to see repeated several times later in the Bible, but you haven't seen it laid out as a principle yet in the book of Genesis, which is that judgment belongs to God. I am God. I will recompense. God is going to be the judge, and he is the one who is going to exact his revenge. And so if that's true, if we know that ultimately God is going to exact an appropriate judgment and revenge against his enemies, then we don't have to go through our lives trying to exact that revenge on our behalf. The principle being that even if you're offended, even if someone has sinned against you, that is far, far less than the sin against God. Because the sin against you is a sin against another sinner. It's still a worm sinning against a worm. But a sin against a holy, righteous God, that's a criminal offense. That's the sort of offense that can actually put you in the lake of fire forever. It's that kind of offense. Because it is an infinite offense, because it's an offense against an infinite God. And so an infinite God can exact an infinite judgment and an infinite revenge for sin against him. And so Joseph takes that view here and says, don't worry about this. I'm not in the place of God. In other words, you may end up under the hand of punishment at some point for what you did, but it's not going to be for me. I'm not God. Which is a concept that I really oftentimes wish more people would get a hold of. That they're not God, that God's God, and God will do the God thing. All you have to do is do your Saint Christian thing, and that will be sufficient. And forgiving, loving your enemies, being patient, kind, long-suffering, slow to anger, all of those very positive attributes of having the Spirit of God in you, sometimes we think, well, I can't be patient. I can't be long-suffering with this guy. Look what he did. I can't put up with that. If you understand that God is right and just, and that he is the judge of the whole world and that he will do right, then it's easier to walk away from an enemy or anyone who has wronged you and just leave them in God's hands and know that God's going to do what's right. And as we've been talking on Sunday mornings, and will again this week, about what our temperament, what our life, what our standards ought to be like by virtue of the fact that we've been saved by this glorious grace, this is another little piece that you can plug in. And you say, well, why? Why should I be forgiving? Why should I be kind? Why should I be long-suffering? And the answer is right here, the beginning of that principle, you're not God. And therefore, any offense you take and any judgment you think you should mete out for that offense has to be tapered by the reality that it's really just an offense against somebody who has also offended God. You've offended God and this person offended you. Gee, which is the worst offense there? An offense against you is just a sinner offending a sinner. Every sin is a sin against God. If God has been merciful to you, then that's just cause to be merciful to other people. And since you're not God, leave it up to God to judge. Right?
Yeah.
Am I alone here? Right?
No.
Okay. And that especially applies, let me say, whenever anybody would like to judge me. Okay, I would also like to put that caveat in place.
Okay.
Oh. Oh, we understand now.
Gina, don't you think, as a person in an authoritative figure such as yourself, that sometimes it's even more challenging for you to be able to guide people when you know that, I mean, you're not judging them, but you're trying to tell them the right things to do, when maybe they might not be as accepting of hearing what you're trying to tell them?
Yeah, but I think there's a big difference between judging in a way where you're trying to exact some kind of vengeance, which is what the brothers were afraid of here. Well, he's going to do the right thing now and teach them God's compatibilism that we've talked so much about. So teaching the truth is always incumbent on any kind of spiritual leader. Absolutely, you never shy away from the truth, as I think our website attests. You never shy away from what's right and what's true, but it took me a long time to get used to, well, I should back up.
Because some people would think you would be a mean, you know, when you were just trying to be firm in what you believed.
Right.
And I remember when I first got here, I was so used to this not truth, that the truth was a little abrasive to me at first, and mm-hmm. then I was hungry for it.
Right. See, the truth of the Bible has a built-in offense. I don't have to work to be offensive. In fact, I work very hard to not be offensive.
You're not.
I just want people to like me. I'm just out here trying to make friends.
I am.
People laugh when I say it, but it's true. But what we teach is an offense to the flesh. But the Bible says that all the way through the Bible, that the real truth of the real God will always be offensive to people's flesh. And so people who are deeply entrenched in fleshly religion are going to be offended by genuine doctrine. It rubs up against them. And especially when you pull the rug out from under everything that gives them a sense of stability, my works, my choice, my will, and then biblical doctrine comes along and yanks that out from under you, it's very unsettling, even though I keep pointing people to the Bible and saying, I didn't say it, this said it, people still want to shoot the messenger. And so I'm used to that. That kind of goes with the gig. But there were a couple of moments over the course of my adult life in ministry and learning how to approach and teach these things, there were a couple of moments that were really key to me. And one was that very freeing realization that I didn't have to save anybody. Once I realized that God will be God, God will save his people, he puts his spirit in particular people. Once he puts his spirit in them, they're caught. There's nothing they can do about it. They're caught by the overwhelming power of God. And I can't do that. I can't put the spirit of God in anybody. So my job is just, if I can put that in quotation marks, my job is just preach the truth.
Deliver the message.
Deliver the message. Let God be God and do his work. The inverse of that that was very helpful was in those early days when people were offended and wanted to fight with me, I was always ready for the fight. I was always in the middle of the debate. I was always right there doing that polemic thing that I was so caught up in. And over the years, I realized that wasn't my job either, that my job was to feed sheep, not argue with goats. And that once people showed that they were going to be goats and that they were going to disagree and argue and be difficult to deal with, that it was okay to leave them to God and go back to just feeding the sheep God had given me to take care of. And so both of those are very freeing. I no longer have to try to save anybody, which is great for my conscience, because then I can go to sleep at night not thinking of the one that got away. And then it's not my job to fight with anybody, which is very freeing because I'm a nice guy. I don't want to fight with anybody. I used to want to fight with people a lot. But that was also kind of part of my personality then, and it fed that part of my flesh and my desire to kind of show that I could be right. Anymore, my argument is the Bible's right. Bring yourself in alignment with the Bible, and your argument's not with me. So I'm going to go get something to eat. Bye. You know? So what Joseph got at here is that judgment belongs, ultimate judgment that leads to punishment and revenge, belongs to God. And when human beings try to exact their own revenge or punishment, then they're acting in the place of God who will take care of those things. Now, the reason that Joseph could say that and come to this conclusion is that he does ultimately now plead God's great compatibilism. We'll see this. Let's keep going. So Joseph wept when they spoke to him. Verse 18. Then his brothers also came and fell down before him, and they said, "Behold, we are your servants." But Joseph said to them, "Don't be afraid, for am I in God's place? And as for you, you meant it for evil against me." See, there's no question about their intention. Their intention was evil, and Joseph recognizes it as evil. And yet he's not trying to exact a revenge because he's not God. But then look at how he talks of God. But God meant it for good in order to bring about this present result to preserve many people alive. And this is, I've talked about compatibilism so many times over the course of the last couple of years, the idea being that the will and intentions of evil men and the ultimate design of an omniscient God who is tracing the course of history so that it will play out in exact accordance to his supreme will, those two ideas are not contrary. People like to think that the idea of an absolutely sovereign God who foreordains, who predestines, who elects, somehow can be overthrown by the fact that human beings are willful and that you see human beings making decisions, choices, and those decisions and choices are always restricted by the capacity of the human being. Sinful people can only choose to do sinful things. That's the only capacity they have. So sinful, evil people choosing and acting sinfully in no way undermines the supreme authority of the will of God, because the will of God supersedes and plays out above and despite the evil of men. And here's yet another example of that. And Joseph lays it out very clearly. You meant what you did for evil, but God meant it for good. Same action. The will and intention of the humans, evil. The will and intention of God, ultimate good. And so it's examples like this throughout the scripture that can drive Paul to write things like in Romans 8 that all things work together for good. And we go, no, there's actually a lot of trouble in life. But the ultimate end of it is the design and plan of God. And so even the evil and the desperate and the upsetting things that happen in this life are ultimately going to be wound up in the supreme exacting and good plan of God. The example that I use constantly that you certainly see mentioned by Peter in the book of Acts, that Herod and Pilate and the Gentiles and the Jews gathered together against Christ to do exactly what God's hand ordained. Now, did Herod and the Jews and Pilate and the Gentiles, did they do exactly what they wanted to do when they killed Christ? Yep. Yeah. And did they do it out of some great desire to see the divine will of God played out? No, they did it because they hated Jesus. And they hated the way they were being convicted of their own sinfulness by this light that was in the world that showed them how dark they were. And so they went to work to destroy him. That was really bad. That was really evil. And yet it had been ordained since before the foundation of the world, and Christ is called the Lamb slain before the foundation of the world. It had always been God's intention that on that particular day, that particular man would die on that particular cross to save his particular people. That plan was always in effect. And yet God used the evil will and the evil intention of evil men to accomplish that very good thing. That's compatibilism. The plan and supreme knowledge of God is not in any way thwarted by the evil that men do. In fact, the evil that men do ultimately redounds to the glory of the God who planned it all anyway.
He couldn't set up a love feast for them to get together.
Yeah, exactly. If you really conceive of God the way he's described in Scripture as being genuinely omniscient, knowing absolutely everything, and if he is completely sovereign and empowering everything that happens, if he is almighty, God Almighty, a proper name, if he is omnipotent, then nothing can happen in his universe that he doesn't empower, which means even the bad things that happen, he is still empowering these people to continue to breathe to even accomplish the next bad thing they choose to do. Why would he allow that? He would only allow that because it plays out to his ultimate goal, which is the glorification of himself in the salvation of those he's gracious to and in the judgment of his enemies.
Didn't do it to punish Joseph.
No, he didn't do it to punish Joseph. Instead, what he did it for was because he had told Abraham that his descendants were going to go into a land where they weren't known, that they were going to serve there for 400 years, that he was going to bring them out and take them back to this very land. He had to get them all down into Egypt. So he used Joseph's brother's hatred of Joseph to get Joseph into Egypt first, then blessed Joseph, made him second only to Pharaoh, then brought the other 11 boys and Israel down to Joseph. They were set up in Goshen, wealthy, well-to-do, so that they would stay there.
And I think it's so wonderful that Joseph didn't seem to ever have the feeling that he just had the feeling that God was using him. He never had the feeling that he was being mistreated.
I expect his couple of years in the prison were not particularly fun, but I think by the time he reaches here, he can look back over all of that and say, I see the hand of God. But isn't that really the way it is with all of us? When you're going through the difficult event, it's very difficult to say, oh, I see God in this. Instead, we're more prone to say, where is God in all this? But once you get through the event and can look back on it, it's much easier to say, wow, God was really genuinely there the whole time and brought me through this. So Joseph was able to say, I am not in the place of God, because what he saw was God's wonderful hand of plan at work, and that God meant all these things for good. The same events that were evil, evilly intended, and were evilly executed, God nevertheless meant for good, specifically to preserve many people alive. So those 12 brothers had to stay alive, and they had to be in Egypt, because that's what God told Abraham was going to happen. And then God used their evil to accomplish the good he had promised Abraham. And then, as soon as we get to the book of Exodus, we're going to see the next part of what God told Abraham, which is they're going to serve there for 400 years. So the book of Exodus is going to start with how they ended up in service, how they ended up in slavery. For 400 years slavery, that's bad, that's not good. But God's going to use it for good in bringing about Moses, a deliverer, and bringing them back to that very land, proving that he is still keeping the promises he made to Abraham. So can God take 400 years of human beings? You got to figure, if you're somebody born in, let's say, the 200th year of the captivity in Egypt, you're going to live and die knowing nothing but slavery in Egypt, because God made a promise to Abraham. Because Abraham asked the question, how will I know that this is really my land? And God said, I'm going to take your people into Egypt. That's how you'll know. And they'll serve there for 400 years. I'll bring them out with a mighty hand. And I'll bring them back to this land. That's how you'll know. Meanwhile, you'll be dead. But that's how you'll know. And so there were people who lived and died in slavery, who were nevertheless descendants of Abraham, who were nevertheless God's chosen people, who lived and died playing a part, and the part was not their great glorification and ultimate good. It was God glorifying himself in proving that he was a faithful God in keeping his word to the people he made the promise to. So you got to think of God and be able to conceive of him with all of those broad nuances, and not just think of him in that limited scope of he wants you personally to be healthy, wealthy, and wise because you're one of his, and therefore you're never going to suffer, and you're never going to have any problems, and you're going to drive a big car, and you're always going to be healthy. You don't see that kind of God in the Bible. You see a God who is so wrapped up in keeping his own word and the glorification of himself that he is even willing to put people through 400 years of slavery just because he said he would. So then we're at verse 21. So therefore, do not be afraid, he says to his brothers, I will provide for you and your little ones. So he comforted them and he spoke kindly to them. Now Joseph stayed in Egypt, he and his father's household. Joseph lived 110 years. And Joseph saw the third generation of Ephraim's sons. So he saw Ephraim, his son, then he saw his grandsons, then he saw his great-grandsons, then he saw his great-great-grandsons before he died. Three generations of the sons of Ephraim, and also he saw the sons of Machir, who was the son of Manasseh. And they were born on Joseph's knees. And Joseph said to his brothers, I am about to die, but God will surely take care of you and bring you up from this land to the land that he promised as an oath to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. So the book of Genesis ends with this recapitulation, this retelling, this restating of the fact that the land of Canaan belongs to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and Joseph giving them the firm promise, God is going to bring you out of here, and he's going to take you back to that land. Now we know, of course, that it's going to take 400 years for that to happen, and that all the patriarchs are going to be dead by the time it happens. Nevertheless, the promise is good, the promise is firm, and we know the end of the story. God does keep that promise through Moses and does actually bring them back to that land. So they should have, when they reach the edge of the land, they should have said, well, here we are. This is that land we've been hearing about, the land that was promised to Abraham. Let's go. And of course, they don't, because human beings just can't get it right. Even if he proves himself over the course of hundreds and hundreds of years, humans will still trust their flesh more than they'll trust God, and we'll get to all that. So, Joseph made the sons of Israel swear, saying, God will surely take care of you, and you shall carry my bones up from here. So Joseph died at the age of 110 years, and he was embalmed and placed in a coffin in Egypt. Exodus 1:1 says, now these are the names of the sons of Israel, which came to Egypt with Jacob. They came each one with his household: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin, Dan, and Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. And all the persons that came from the loins of Jacob were 70 in number, but Joseph was already in Egypt. And Joseph died, and all his brothers, and all that generation. But the sons of Israel were fruitful, and they increased greatly. And they multiplied, and they became exceedingly mighty, so that the land was filled with them. Now, if you turn back a little bit, in the book of Genesis, I think it's 46. Yes. In chapter 46, as God is bringing Israel, Jacob, down into Egypt, starting in verse 2, God spoke to Israel in visions in the night and said, Jacob, Jacob. And he said, here I am. And he said, I am God, the father of your father. Don't be afraid to go down to Egypt, for I will make you a great nation there, down in Egypt. I'm going to make you a great nation while you're in Egypt. I will surely go down with you to Egypt, and I will also surely bring you up again, and Joseph will close your eyes. In other words, your son Joseph is the one who's going to bury you. So the book of Exodus naturally begins with that the sons of Israel were fruitful, and they increased greatly, and they multiplied, and they became exceedingly mighty. Exactly what God had told Jacob he would do to his descendants in Egypt. And the land was filled with them. Now a new king arose over Egypt who did not know Joseph. The reason that's important is he wouldn't have remembered what Joseph did for the land of Egypt, or that a whole generation of Egyptians survived because Joseph had read Pharaoh's dreams and interpreted and had properly planned so that they could live through that 7-year drought. Nor would that king, that Pharaoh, have remembered that the reason he was sitting on the kind of power he was sitting on was because Joseph was the one who got all the people to sell first their money and then their cattle and then themselves into slavery, so that by the time this Pharaoh came along, he was riding that wave of power that Joseph had amassed for the Pharaohs. And so a king comes up who doesn't remember Joseph, doesn't remember that history. A new king rose up in Egypt who did not know Joseph, and he said to his people, behold, the people of the sons of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come and let us deal wisely with them, lest they multiply, and in the event of war, they also join themselves to those who hate us, and they fight against us and depart from the land. So they appointed taskmasters over them to afflict them with hard labor. And they built for Pharaoh storage cities, Pithom and Ramses. But the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied, and the more they spread out, so that they were in dread of the sons of Israel. And the Egyptians compelled the sons of Israel to labor rigorously. And they made their lives bitter with hard labor in mortar and bricks and at all kinds of labor in the field, all their labors which they rigorously imposed on them. Doesn't that seem like a tremendous hardship that suddenly this generation of Israel was enduring? They'd become a great number of people in Egypt. They'd been thriving. And then suddenly a king puts them into slavery. This would have seemed like a tremendous difficulty and hardship for them. Why did it happen?
To fulfill what God said.
He said to Abraham, I'll take them into a land where they're not known, and they'll serve them there for 400 years. God intended 400 years of slavery for the descendants of Abraham. That simply isn't the way he's being preached these days. That God of health, wealth, prosperity, who wants everybody to prosper. This is the same God. The same God who said to Abraham, everywhere you look, everywhere your foot touches, I'm going to give this land to you and your descendants. What a great promise. How will I know that this land will be mine? Okay, I'm going to take them into Egypt, and there's going to be 400 years of bondage and slavery, and then I'll bring them back to this very land. And then doesn't include, and oh yeah, the first generation I bring out of Egypt, I'll kill them all in the wilderness, and the second generation will come in.
this is still the same God, acting the same way this God acts. This is a very consistent personality profile of a completely sovereign God who does whatever he wants to do. And these people were going through a tremendous amount of difficulty and hardship for many, many generations because God is faithful and keeps his word. And it would have been very, very difficult for them to conceive of, I'm going through this difficulty because God is faithful. We think of God's faithfulness as being, I rose up from my sickness because God is faithful. You know, God paid my bills because God is faithful. Things went well in my life because God is faithful. This is a prime example of a huge multitude of people whose lives got very bad, much worse, because God is faithful.
For a long time.
For a long time.
Yes, but they got a lot stronger because of it.
Well, these first few generations just die, so... And I don't know how much stronger they got, because even after the Red Sea thing, they still get to Canaan and say, now we can't do this. So I don't see a great deal of them becoming stronger. Instead, what you...
reproduced.
Yes, now I'll give you that one. The reproduction element was heavy, yes. So then the king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shiphrah, and the other was named Puah. Names that I'm sure you young girls are happy have fallen out of popular use. And he said, when you are helping the Hebrew women to give birth, and you see them upon the birth stool, if it is a son, then you shall put him to death. But if it is a daughter, you'll let her live. But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt had commanded them, but let the boys live. So the king of Egypt called for the midwives and said to them, why have you done this thing and let the boys live? And the midwives said to Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they're vigorous, kind of like I think you just said. For they are vigorous and they give birth before the midwife can even get to them. Well, it turns out that that wasn't always true, but they're giving an excuse here to Pharaoh, kind of to save their own hides. But look at verse 20. So God was good to the midwives. And the people multiplied, and they became very mighty. And it came about, because the midwives feared God, that he established households for them. Then Pharaoh commanded all his people, saying, every son who is born you are to cast into the Nile, and every daughter you are to keep alive. Chapter 2 is going to introduce us then to the birth of Moses. And we're going to see the first of many, what are really, I think, just great ironies that Moses writes into this story, showing that God has a great sense of humor and a great sense of irony, because the command from the king was, you're going to drown all the young boys in the Nile. And so God is going to use the River Nile to float Moses right into the household of the man who wanted to kill all the boys. Because God has a great sense of irony. So we'll get to the birth of Moses and the beginning of the book of Exodus next week. But had it been me, I would have kind of attached the beginning of the book of Exodus and the end of the book of Genesis, because they really do flow, as I think you just saw. They flow from one into the next, and the story just keeps going. If you take anything away from this evening, two things. One, a completely sovereign God can do whatever he wants. And since when dealing with the Hebrews, who were his people, of all the families and nations on the earth, those were the people he chose. But he didn't choose them in order to enrich them. He chose them to glorify himself in what he did with them and through them. And he put them into slavery for 400 years for his own faithfulness and for his own glory. Which means every day that he's good to you, that's because he was just being really kind and gracious to you. Say thank you. He's under no obligation to give you a closet full of clothes and air conditioning and carpet under your feet and a couple of cars in the driveway and food in the refrigerator and a comfy bed to sleep on. And if he stripped away everything you had, if he treated you like he treated Job, if you ended up sitting on an ash heap using a piece of pottery to cut your boils, he's still God.
Though he slay me,
yet I will trust him. Yep. I remember having this conversation with my brother once after he saw some of the things that I went through in 2001 and 2003. And One of the things he said to me was, you know, I admire that your faith has been built up through all of these things. You certainly could have gone a completely different direction based on the hardships that you endured. He said, but it also scares me to know that God will deal with people he loves this way. And I said, do you find any other God in the Bible? The only God you find in the Bible deals with the people he loves sometimes by throwing them in a pit, sometimes by having them accused of rape falsely and then spending 2 years in prison all the time knowing you had properly told the cupbearer he was going to be restored and all you asked was, when you get to the king, remember me, and you spend 2 more years in the prison down there while this guy forgets about you. And same God, same hardship. Ultimately, it led to God's good and many people being saved alive. 400 years, many, many generations of Hebrews were born, lived, and died in slavery in Egypt because God was being faithful to a promise he made to Abraham. And the only way to explain that is to understand the big picture, which must have been incredibly difficult for those middle generations to do, which is why they became Aholah and Aholabah, which is why they began worshiping foreign gods, Egyptian gods, which is why they did completely leave the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in favor of those foreign lovers that they took until they fell under the hand of the condemnation of God. Did God know all that was going to happen? Yes, of course. He's the God who said he was going to do all that. Was that for their good? No. Was it for his glory? Absolutely. And that's the way the real God of the Bible works. So I'll say it again. If he's been good to you, thank him. He was under no obligation, and he has a long, rich history of being God all by himself and doing whatever it is he wants to do. You're not so particularly important that it would upset his reputation if he made life hard for you. So every time it's another good day and you ate and you knew your name and you had somebody that loved you and you loved them and you had a place to sleep and some food in your belly, go back to that God and say thank you again and again and again. Because he was good to you for his own reasons, and that's why it's grace, 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 grace.
So good to this whole nation.
So good to this nation, and that kind of takes us full circle to what we were talking about at the beginning. He's been so good to this nation, and this nation has turned its back on him and driven him out of our schools and out of our culture and out of our thought. So should that God continue to bless this nation? There's certainly no reason to, and in fact, I see the hand of God's judgment on this nation by the very fact that you see less and less of God and hear less and less of God as he withdraws himself from our culture. It's a scary thing, but it's also the way that God has always acted. So once again, if you know him and he knows you, say thank you, because he can withdraw himself from entire nations and let them fall under his hand of judgment. There are chilling passages in the Bible, like in the book of Thessalonians, when it says that when the Antichrist comes on the scene, that God will, among the inhabitants of the earth, he turns them over to a strong delusion that they will believe the lie and be damned. And that's the same God working the same way for his own glory. If he didn't do that to you, say thank you.
Well, one of the prophecies in the Old Testament that says that God will rise to shake the earth and mankind will be scarcer than the gold of Ophir.
Absolutely. If he waits much longer, though, I mean, I don't know how he can. I mean, cataclysm seems almost inevitable now. But, you know, I'm also glad that that same God who does things the way he wants to do it says he'd take his church out first. Okay, good. I'm with that. I'd rather watch that whole thing over the balcony. I'd rather just kind of look down on it and go, yep, there he goes. That's what he said he was going to do. He's that sovereign.
Thank you for joining us for this week's lesson. If you would like more information about Grace Christian Assembly or the teaching of God's sovereign grace, please visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org.